Hey everybody, Wasilla Steve here from Alaska. You know, I listen to five or six podcasts regularly, and one of them is The Handgun World. And why? Because I, too, am a cancer survivor. And because Bob survived cancer, and I survived cancer, Bob got the pleasure of teaching me in two of his classes. And boy, did he ever enjoy that. And I'm not trying to brag or anything, but he taught the best student he has ever had, that being my good friend who attended the classes with me. So here now, a true survivor, a great American, and hands down, one of the best instructors I know, Bob Main.
Hi folks, I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. This is episode number 370 of the Handgun World podcast, a practical show done by a practical guy like me. Well, this 370th episode is going to contain a rebroadcast of an interview I did with Gabe Suarez back in September of 2011. But it's also a real episode because I have some topics I want to cover besides this interview. You're going to like this interview. It goes back, well, it's actually episode 118 was where this interview came from with Gabe Suarez. And I really think if you haven't heard this already, again, if you don't have a chance to go back and listen to some of my older shows, please do. Go to handgunworld.com. You can stream them off the website. But about once a month or so, I rebroadcast. I pick an old episode, and it just so happens that the last few have been from 2011. But I'm going to start picking some others as well and maybe go back even farther than that. And I rebroadcast it for you so you can kind of get reminded or in case you didn't hear it. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about one of my AR-15s before I get started. And before I get into my AR-15 issue that I had, let me remind you that on September 17th, Saturday, September 17th, I am teaching Beyond Concealed Carry Advanced. Ben Branham was going to teach this with me, but he's got a scheduling conflict, so I will be your instructor. It'll be a one-day class. We're condensing our two-day advanced class down to one day, so you only have to spend one day listening to me. But I think you're going to love this class. It's called Worst Case Scenarios, and we've added a little bit to the curriculum, so even those of you who have taken our advanced class before, come to this one. You're going to like it. It's in San Antonio at Lone Star Handgun Shooting Range. Go to handgunworld.com, click the training classes page, and you can read and see all about it, and you can sign up for it. One day, from 9 to about 5 or 5:30 on that day, we're going over some advanced techniques. You have to have a prerequisite. You have to have had some kind of training class that taught you how to draw from a holster safely. So if you hadn't had such a class and you want to come to Beyond Concealed Carry Advanced with me as your instructor, find a class to go to where you can get the basics of drawing from a holster safely and shooting safely. You know, if you're a competitive shooter and you've achieved a decent classification, you know, a classification that's beyond, beyond marksman, like if you're a sharpshooter or an expert and you can show me your competition classification, I would say that's going to be good enough because I know that you are a safe and responsible gun handler, or you probably would not have achieved that competition classification. So that will also work as a prerequisite. All right, let me talk about my AR-15. I've got more than one AR-15, but I want to specifically talk about one of the ARs that I used at John Payne's M4 rifle gunfighting class last month. You know, John told us after the first day, because it was raining a lot, he said, you know, make sure you go back home or go back to your hotel room and maintain your firearm, you know, clean it, lubricate it well, and, you know, take care of it, you know, even though you're probably going to be shooting it again soon. Or he said, if you plan on shooting it again soon, excuse me, make sure that you maintain it. Well, guess what? I didn't do that. I got distracted. I forgot about it. You know, life got in the way. And this is what can happen to you, folks. I did not. So it got wet. I shot probably about 200 rounds through it the first day, 150 to 200 rounds. Obviously, the inside of the chamber got wet, the bolt carrier got wet, and it just wasn't a very good situation weather-wise. Well, guess what? I didn't clean it. I put it back in the case. The next day, I shot the other AR-15 I have, the piston-driven primary weapon systems AR. And that's, matter of fact, that's kind of got one of those nickel-boron bolt carrier groups. And that one I didn't clean either, but I had no problem with that because, boy, I tell you, that finish, that works. That nickel boron or nickel, whatever they call it, coating on the bolt carrier group, that works. Boy, they say that you can go many thousands of maintenance-free rounds with that rifle, and I believe them. Of course, I'm not going to test that. So guess what happened? My direct impingement AR, so I didn't clean the thing, right? It locked up on me. It froze up. When I pulled it out about 2.5 weeks later, 2.5, 3 weeks later, I could not pull back. I could not charge the weapon. I pulled as hard as I possibly could on the charging handle, and that sucker was frozen up. It was locked up. Now, I talked to John Payne a little bit about it, and he guessed correctly that probably it just, because of the dirt in it, the carbon of dirt or whatever, and all that crap, and it getting wet, it didn't rust, but it just kind of fused together or did something inside the chamber that was not good. Probably got all gummed up or hardened or whatever, all the junk in there and the lubrication and the water and the mixture of all that. And, you know, keeping the bolt closed, which was a bad mistake. I had the bolt closed the whole time that it was in the case. Couldn't get that. I pulled on it with all my might, and I could not charge that weapon. So what I did is I took the upper off of the lower, and I used gun scrubber. John said, just get some gun scrubber and spray it inside as much as you can. So taking the upper off of the lower, that made a huge difference. I was able to get the gun scrubber up in there as much as I could, you know, that Birchwood Casey gun scrubber that you buy. And because of the pressure, you know, squirting that stuff out, I got it in there and I let it sit for several hours. And I tried pulling back on the charging handle again, still wouldn't come out. And at first I had thought that there was a round in there that somehow I left in there. But I did not, because I properly unloaded my weapon and double-checked and triple-checked before I put it away. But after some time went by, I couldn't remember if I had done that. So I checked, and there was no round in there. So what I did is I went and I got a rubber mallet. And I figured I was going to break my charging handle, but I had to get this thing, loose. So I took a risk. I figured, well, you know what? This is my training AR-15. It's not my top tier AR-15. And if I break a few things, I'll just buy some new parts. Well, I tapped on it lightly with a rubber mallet after spraying a bunch of gun scrubber in there and leaving it for a couple of hours. And it budged a little bit, and I thought, oh, great. You know, I got it to budge like about an eighth of an inch. So a little bit more gun scrubber, a little more yanking on it, a little more tapping and tapping and tapping, you know, a little harder each time with the rubber mallet. And finally, I popped that thing loose. And it was all gummy in there. It was all hardened up Some of it was gummy and some of it was hardened up, and it was nasty. It was just absolutely nasty. So I gave that thing an incredibly good cleaning. Everything, barrel, chamber, bolt carrier group, bolt, extractor, you name it. I was cleaning it. I had that rifle quite a bit, mostly taken apart, and I just scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed. And I used gun scrubber. I used a little bit of bore solvent. And after I got everything all cleaned up nicely, lots of lube, lots of good lube everywhere. You know, I love Militech. I just put Militech lube all over it. I mean, I didn't over-lube it, because you should never over-lube. And that might have been part of my problem in the first place. Although, I've kind of learned not to over-lube. And it's working. It's working fine. It's working very well now. It's back to normal. So, lesson learned, folks. Learn from my stupid experience of not cleaning my weapon. AR-15s are not as forgiving in harsh environments. And I proved that. Of course, lots of people have proven that. But I proved it. Now, they're forgiving if you do the proper maintenance on them, which I did not do. So, lesson learned. I will never let that happen again. As a matter of fact, when I got done with that one, I pulled out the other AR-15 and I cleaned it. Even though it's got the nickel boron bolt carrier group and all that stuff, I still just, you know, cleaned it up really, really, really good and got it all lubed up. So, take care of the AR-15s and they will take care of you. Don't take care of them and they won't be so kind to you. And hey, by the way, when I had to force it open by tapping on the charging handle, I didn't break anything. I didn't break anything. So credit to the BCM charging handle, the BCM tactical charging handle. That thing did not break. Nice product that they make. I like it quite a bit. So, another thing I wanted to mention about AR-15s, I just ordered a PSA, Palmetto State Armory, complete lower with a Magpul stock, Magpul MOE stock. And that's on its way. That is going to hold my primary weapon systems MK-114 upper. And I'm going to put my SIG M400 back together, because right now that primary weapon systems upper is sitting on top of my SIG M400 lower. And so I'm going to put my SIG M400 back together and get an optic for that. And then, of course, I'll have my Delton AR. That's pretty much been given the task of being my vehicle gun. Not a gun that I realistically think I'm going to be able to get to if I'm in a fight in my vehicle, but a rifle I can get out of my trunk in case I'm stranded somewhere and I've got to go on foot and I've got to try to get home or try to get to some help. And if things are nasty, a nasty situation, I've got that. Or even if I've got to stay with my vehicle and defend myself for some reason and I want something more than a handgun, I have that Delton DTI 15 in my trunk with several magazines and lots of good defensive ammo. It's also a gun I love to train with, I like to compete with, and go to carbine matches. And of course, my primary weapon systems, 14 and a half inch barrel with a 2-inch flash suppressor on it to make it legal. That's a fun competition gun too, because it is piston driven. It's a long stroke piston, which I'm really liking that. Check it out. Go to primaryweaponsystems.com and check out the MK-114. I think you'll be impressed with that. It's a long. Their design is really good. I think when I can save up a little bit more money, I might buy another one of those. I might buy a complete rifle, but I might, if they got some other calibers, I might see if I can get it in a different caliber than 223, because already got. Well, once I get my new lower in, I'll have three of those. Don't think I need another one. 1/8 barrel twist. 223 is chambered in 223 wild, which I really like, which is kind of cool. You got to read up on that. I think it's pretty good. My SIG M400 is got a 1/7 twist in the barrel. I love that. And my Delton is a 1/9 twist. You know, some people make big deals about that. Some don't. I'm just giving you the specs. You know, I'm not a good enough shooter for a lot of that stuff to make much of a difference for me. But for some people, it makes a lot of difference. Okay. From 2011, I had a chance to interview the only time that Gabe Suarez has actually interviewed on the Handgun World podcast. It's the only time. I'm trying to get him to come on again and talk about some of the new things that they're doing and some of the other training and things that they offer. But this was an informative discussion. It's not just a big commercial for the Suarez International Training Classes. Not just a big commercial for that. I asked Gabe some listener questions, and I asked him some pretty pointed questions about concealed carry and defending yourself and things, which I really think that you're going to enjoy. Here we go, Gabe Suarez from 2011. Okay, everybody. Well, for the main topic of this episode, I have two guests with me, and I'm stoked up about this. I know it's going to be a good show. I've got Gabe Suarez, founder of Suarez International, and I got John Payne, Suarez International staff instructor. How you guys doing?
Doing great, Bob. Doing good.
Well, thanks for coming on. You know, Gabe, hey, let me start with you real quick. I understand you guys have been teaching a course down there in Orange, Texas today, right?
Yeah.
What have you been teaching?
We were teaching advanced rifle.
Advanced rifle. Cool. Cool. So, I know that's not really the main topic of this subject here, of this show that I want to do, but tell them a little bit about advanced rifle. Talk about that course.
Well, it's as the name, you know, implies. It's for guys that already sort of know how to run their guns, how to shoot. They have the fundamentals down and everything. And, we give them a pretty good presentation for, close quarter battle, you know, fighting inside, houses and rooms and things like that. And then we expand a little bit farther out and we put them through some reasonably advanced drills, you know, a lot of running and shooting and stuff like that.
Cool.
It's a lot of fun. It's good class.
Yeah, I was talking with John just the other day, and rifle's not something I've spent a lot of time training on, so I'm going to work my way up the ladder on that, but that sounds like a blast. You know, before we get in talking about close-range gunfighting and so forth, Gabe, there are people I know that are going to be listening to this show that don't know much about you and don't know much about your school and your classes and so forth. So if you don't mind, take a few minutes, give them a little background and kind of whet their appetite a little bit.
Well, as far as me, I've been doing martial arts since I was 10 years old. I got into law enforcement and I did about 15 years in that, and I worked a lot of you know, dangerous assignments, SWAT and gangs and you know, cool stuff like that. And at some point I you know, just got the idea to start doing some teaching, and I started that up about 2001, and you know, began small like everybody does, and you know, the business kind of took off. We've been growing it ever since, and it's been doing really well.
It is. I love what you teach. I've been to two of your classes. And, you know, Glenn Matthews is a tremendous instructor. I'm looking forward to working with John at Close Range Gunfighting again. I've read tons of your articles. I'm a subscriber to your Warrior Talk newsletter. You got some great stuff on there. So do your contributors to that. I've read countless posts of yours on the Warrior Talk forums. And, I'm really impressed, and I'm glad you took this time to come on. So how many classes every year does SI put on?
Wow, I'd have to look at the schedule to tell you. I know that we've got about 50 contract instructors around the world, and, you know, they each hold approximately, you know, one class a month. So, we're really busy. We've had, some, industry insiders that we're doing, you know, some alliances with and some other work with, and they've done their homework, and they tell me that we are the largest private sector training organization in the world. So that was pretty gratifying to hear.
Yeah, congratulations. Simple math tells me that's about 600 courses a year, if not more. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
All right, well, so let's get into it. Let's talk about close-range gunfighting. First of all, thanks for setting it up to have John come up here to the Dallas area. And this class is obviously filling up pretty quick, isn't it, John?
It's doing very well. I'm very impressed with the numbers.
Good. Let's start with some listener questions. I put out an email and a post on the Gun Rights Radio Network forum asking people to get back to me with some questions for you guys. I had three people that sent in, and I've got a couple myself, but one of them here I think is pretty cool, and I want to start off with this one. There's a gentleman that wrote in from North Carolina. His name is Lawrence. And, you know, he's talking about the capability of taking someone's life, if you have to use your handgun to take someone's life. Let me read this to you, see what you think. He says if you're not capable of taking a life, he listened to a sheriff make a statement on the news once, and the sheriff said, if you're not capable of taking a life, then just don't buy a gun. He says it might sound reasonable to the general public, but something to him sounded a little wrong. And the question to you guys is, he wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Well, it depends on why you bought the gun. If you bought it for hunting or sports or something like that, then, you know, it is what it is. It's a toy. But if you bought it as a weapon to protect yourself, then, yeah, I mean, the extension of it is you bought this and carrying it around with you for self-defense. And, you know, the bottom line about the self-defense thing is you're going to shoot somebody that tries to kill you. So, yeah, absolutely. You have to be clear in your mind. You have to get your mind right about that you're carrying this because one day some bad person will try and harm you, and you're carrying this so you can kill them with it. You know, I think a lot of gun instructors and organizations and so on, they want to mince words about that sort of thing. In the previous centuries, you know, in the 1800s, 1700s, nobody really worried about that or made such a big deal about it. I don't know why we have to make such a big deal about it today. There are bad people out there that will try and take what you have. They'll try and harm you and harm your family. And why do you have any sentiment for those folks?
I agree with you. And, you know, I think a lot of that comes from the anti-gunners out there. I think that's kind of where people like Lawrence hear this kind of stuff from. And, you know, it's interesting that a sheriff would make that statement because, you know, I've heard a lot of law enforcement officials say the opposite.
Well, yeah, he God bless him for speaking the truth. That's all I'll say.
I know, because it seems like there's a lot of law enforcement out there that won't speak the truth about that.
That's true.
Okay, well, another question comes from a guy named Jim in California. This is a cool one here. His question is about handgun fit. And what he means by that is he's got a handgun that he says doesn't really fit his hand very well, in his opinion. He wanted to know, Gabe, what your thoughts are. How do you rate the fit of the handgun to your hand? How do you rate that in terms of importance level? How important is that to being able to shoot it effectively and defend yourself with it?
You know, the only real concern there is, you know, if you have a small hand, don't go out and get some Desert Eagle type thing. You know, get something that, you know, is gonna fit your hand size. You know, for example, if you're a lady, don't go out and get a Glock 21. You know, get something smaller that actually you can grab onto and use. But other than that, I mean, you know, sometimes guys, they act like they're buying a pair of shoes or something, and it's not that complicated. You go to the gun store, you know what, just grab the thing, hold it in your hand. If it feels good, it's probably okay. If it feels too big, it's probably too big.
It's funny you use the buying a shoes example. I mean, you know, I'm one of the world's worst at that. I'm like a woman when I go buy shoes. I mean, I'm so fussy, but you're right. With guns, it shouldn't be that way.
Now, I'll step in here, Bob, and I'll tell you, you know, any quality handgun will do just fine. I don't care if it's an XD. I don't care if it's an M&P. I don't care if it's a Glock. It's a quality handgun, and it functions as it was intended to function, and you use quality ammunition, quality gear. That's the important thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't handle the recoil of a 45, well, why buy one?
Yeah.
A 9mm. If you can't handle the recoil of a 40 Smith & Wesson, if it causes you to, you know, worry more about recoil than it does about your precision, then don't use that caliber, or practice to where you don't worry about that. You worry about getting the hits and not about the gun recoil.
Yeah, good point, John. This next question I want to I've been saving the best one, I think, for last. A guy wrote in, he said, you know, Gabe, he knows you teach a lot about moving off of the X, and I remember that from the first time I took close-range gunfighting. Mark wrote to me and he says, ask Gabe this. He says, I agree that moving off the X explosively is an important and a life-saving skill. But he says he doesn't have a lot of range resources to practice this kind of stuff. So he wanted to know how effective is it for him to move and, you know, practice on his own, stop, move, dry fire practice, stuff like that.
Well, I think that, that's a situation a lot of guys are in. You know, they live in an urban area that, you know, they have maybe an indoor range within driving distance. And, you know, it's one of these places where you have to fire one shot per second and very, Nazi in terms of the range rules and all that sort of thing. And, you know, a lot of people are in that boat. What I would say is, use the resources that you have. In other words, go to that range and practice your marksmanship. Practice, your fundamentals. So, you know, at the very least, you've got a little bit of stuff you can work in that environment. But there's a great deal of development that can take place in the dry work. Myself, I probably practice for every hour that I actually shoot, I probably put in a good 8 to 10 hours of dry work. Every day, a few minutes here, a few minutes there, and it adds up. You don't have to go and do everything live fire all the time, but you do have to practice it all the time.
That's a good point. So, and if you can't live fire at the range, at least practice what you know.
Absolutely. Just practice it dry. The cool thing about dry practice is it's free. It doesn't cost anything. You know, all it takes is an open area in your garage, your living room, whatever, where you can just, you know, make sure your guns are unloaded, you know, close the drapes so you don't scare your liberal neighbors. And, just spend a half hour or 20 minutes and just practice the skills that you need to practice.
Gabe, I don't care if I scare my liberal neighbors. I could care less.
I don't have any liberal neighbors.
I do. I live in the suburbs. Even though I'm in Dallas, even though this is Texas, there are liberals around here, actually. But, now the hate mails. You know what? As soon as I get done posting this and somebody hears this, now the hate mails from the liberals are going to start coming in, I think.
Tell them it's my fault. Okay.
Yeah, you're the one that brought it up. So I'm just going to say send it to Gabe.
So there's no confusion. There's liberals that listen to the Handgun World Show podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, there are. There are some liberals that listen to this podcast. Absolutely.
As liberals as I think they are.
Well, you never know about that. I mean, that's a whole nother subject. You wouldn't believe some of the emails that I receive. It's, pretty interesting. I mean, some of the people that send me stuff, you can tell their political views are extremely liberal. However, they are very much into firearms and concealed carry. Scratch my head over that one because a lot of the politicians that they support want to take those rights away from them, but I guess that's a whole nother subject.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Well, back on a non-political subject. Gabe, talk about SI courses and close range gunfighting. What do you think differs your school from a lot of the others that are out there?
Well, that's a big question. I'll try and give you a concise answer. Close range gunfighting, it came about because I didn't want to teach the same things that everybody was teaching. First of all, I didn't really believe in it. And I had my own experiences about what somebody needed to do to win a gunfight. You know, that's what we're talking about. You know, guys will buy a pistol, they'll carry it around, they'll get the CCW license or CHL, but, you know, they never come to terms with, okay, we're carrying this to win a gunfight. If somebody attacks you with, a baseball bat and you have a gun, it's a gunfight. If he tries to shoot you and you have a gun, it's a gunfight. So, you know, I wanted to have a sort of truth in teaching, truth in training sort of a perspective with this. And what I did is I basically cleared the table and I said, where do we want to end up when the student has done this course? And I built the course around that. And with the idea that the majority of these things are close range, you're going to have multiple adversaries and maybe reduced light. You know, all those things that we've learned from personal experience, from reading the experiences of others, statistics and whatnot. And I built the course around that. So at the end of the class, 2 days, a bunch of ammunition, a bunch of information. The student that has gone through that class has a pretty good idea of what it's going to take to win that gunfight.
I like that. And I like what you said, you know, to win the gunfight. John, I got a question for you in a minute, but Gabe, if you would just expand on one more thing on that. What's your concept of winning a gunfight?
Well, you know, here's the thing. If a bad guy comes to kill you and you manage to outdraw him and you point the gun at him and he runs away and nobody gets shot, you know what? That's cool with me, right?
Yes.
The final objective is you get to go home and tell the story, right? Now, if that entails you pointing the gun at the bad guy running away, and you running away and getting home, that's cool with me. But oftentimes that's not what happens. The bad guy is not impressed with your pistol. You know, the days we live in today are different than in the 1960s and 1970s, where, you know, the bad guy made a threat, and you pulled out a nickel-plated 1911 with, you know, ivory stocks and everything else, and the bad guy screamed in horror and ran off into the night. The bad guy's not intimidated by the gun anymore. And so, you know, he may press the issue. And then, you know, you have to shoot the bad guy. The bad guy's dead. You're still alive. You won the gunfight. So as long as you achieve the objective, which is after everything is said and done, shots either fired or not fired, whatever the case is, you get to go home and tell the story. The bad guy, whatever happens with him, is not important.
Gabe, did those days ever really exist where the pistol impressed him and they left the scene?
Well, I'm told they existed. I never experienced that myself. You know, back when I was working in Southern California, the bad guys were used to seeing guns pointed at them. They weren't impressed. What they did respect was the person holding the gun. If they thought that the person holding the gun, you know, was just as willing to pull the trigger as they were, they respected that.
And that kind of goes back to the very first question from the listener about, you know, can you pull the trigger, you know, about the sheriff saying, hey, if you're not going to be prepared to use it, then don't even carry a gun at all.
You know, if I was going to go get in some trouble tonight, I would rather have somebody with just merely adequate marksmanship skills that I knew had made up their mind that, yeah, I'll drop the hammer on a bad guy, than the world champion master competition shooter that had qualms about taking another life.
Good point. Good point. No matter how good of a shooter you are, if you're not ready to use it, you're kind of screwed.
Yep.
So, John, my question for you, I know you have a law enforcement and a military background, don't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so this question is for me. This is something I've been thinking about. What has close-range gunfighting and teaching that course and taking that course, what has that done for you? How has it differed from some of the training you received in law enforcement and military?
It bridged the gap of the unknowns. It took a square range mentality of simply drawing to beat the timer and putting shots on target from a stationary position to, you know, the mindset of this target's going to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be here when he does.
And you didn't get that kind of training before, did you?
It wasn't available. They never heard of it. Strictly, my entire background with law enforcement and military was always the modern technique style shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I told you in an earlier interview, that I had never seen what I saw when I attended my first Swords International course.
Which was what?
Which was the active shooter terrorist interdiction.
Okay.
There was material there that I had seen before. Gabe and I have very similar backgrounds. We both started martial arts at a young age. Back when I was a lot younger, the instructors that I had aren't the same as the ones that we have now. They weren't so concerned about having insurance and about, having the Karate Kid daycare. You know, if I messed up on one of my kata, you know, my instructor would kick me in the leg or he'd knock me in the head. You know, he was concerned about me doing it right, not about making friends with, you know, somebody's six-year-old kid.
Yeah, or with the parents of that kid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it was all about the combat aspect of what we were doing. And what Gabe has effectively done is taking
a lot of the movement and philosophy of the martial arts world, of what I consider to be the quintessential martial arts world, and incorporated that into gunfighting. I mean, what is gunfighting? What are you doing? What are we training for? It is a martial art involving firearms.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I never thought of it that way. Hey, Gabe, I got a question for you.
Yes.
You're responsible for converting me, even though you weren't there directly, taking your courses, reading your forum and so forth, for converting me over to Glocks and 9mm. I started off a 1911 shooter. I had two fancy schmancy Kimber 45 1911s that I paid a hell of a lot of money for, that I lost a lot of money on when I sold and bought Glocks. You know, and you and a couple of other people are one of the reasons why. Now, I know this is kind of a sticky question and it causes a lot of arguments, but I don't think you're going to mind it too much. Why Glocks and why 9mm Glocks?
Okay, well, you know, if it causes arguments, I mean, I'm not really too worried about that. I'm burned in effigy somewhere in the world at least every 24 hours. So, well, all right. You know, what I like about the Glocks and similar systems. So for example, the Glock system is very much emulated today. The M&P, well, that's like an American Glock. You know, the XD is the Croatian Glock. You know, so there's the concept of the striker fired, short trigger, system is very, very popular today.
Yeah, it
what
is.
What I like about them. Okay, very simple to use. There are no safeties, there are no levers, nothing. You grab it, you point it at the bad guy, you press the trigger, the gun fires. You don't really need, a lot of modifications to the gun. I remember when I first started studying, handguns, you went to a school, they sat you down, they gave you a 2-hour lecture on modifying the pistol. They talked about high visibility sight, they talked about triggers, they talked about checkering, they talked about this and that. All of that comes out of the box with the Glock. It's the easiest gun to teach a beginner to use, in my opinion. It's also light. I've got a Glock 19 stuck in my belt right now. I forgot it was there until I thought about it just now. It's very light, easy to carry, and easy to fix. We had one Glock 19 basically break down today because of wear. It had, you know, hundreds of thousands of rounds through it, I imagine. And it was a simple thing. Disassemble, take out one part, put another part back in, good to go. So, you know, that's the simplicity of it is very nice. Also, the economy of it. You know, we were looking at a website here recently, that was selling used police Glocks for $300 or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. And these guns are just as good as the day they came out of the box.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, those used police Glocks, haven't been used too much, have they?
Not too much, unfortunately. So, you know, that's the issue with the pistol, not with the ammunition. Okay, it's 2011, all right, not 1976. Today, there has been a great amount of research done on anti-personnel ammo. I remember back in the 80s when I first started law enforcement, you know, you had full metal jacket, you had soft points, and, you know, the really, really badass type guys, you know, carried some sort of hollow point, which wasn't available in every caliber. And, you know, that was all there was. It was mostly sporting ammunition or target ammunition. Today, you know, several years later, I mean, you know, you can confuse yourself with the amount of self-defense and anti-personnel ammunition that there is. A lot of advances have been made. So a 9mm from 2011 is not the same as a 9mm from 1911. It's a whole different animal. I have seen, bad guys on the street, shot, you know, with all sorts of calibers. If they're shot in the right place, they all fall down. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a number of private students that are emergency room doctors, they see gunshot wounds all the time. And, you know, what they tell me is this. When a victim of a gunshot is brought in, you know, even with an MRI, they can't tell what caliber he was shot with because of the, you know, the deformation and expansion of the projectile. It's only after the bullet is pulled out and they're able to, you know, the forensics people are able to examine it and everything else, they can tell what caliber it was. But, You know, a 9mm that expands and a 45 that expands and a 40 that expands and everything else, they are all so very similar that there's almost no discernible difference downrange. Now, the issue with it is an average sized man can get a Glock 17 to fit his hand, and he's got 18 rounds available to him, which, I mean, you can't argue with that.
That's right. That's right. Well, and he can, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, I heard a weird noise in the connection. So, yeah, so an average guy can get a Glock 17 to fit his hand, and it's a light pistol, and it's got high capacity, and it'll get the job done if he places the rounds where they need to be placed.
That's right.
So,
I'll tell you something else. A 9mm is very easy to shoot. All right? My wife and my kids, all three of them, shoot 9mm, and they get very, very good results when they train. Now, if I was to suddenly say, well, you know, the 9mm speed and everything else, and I convert everybody to Glock 21s, all right, probably they wouldn't be shooting as well. They'd have a marginally more powerful caliber, but they wouldn't be placing the rounds as well. So, you know, what's better, a miss with a 45 or a hit with a 9? I would say a hit with a 9.
Absolutely. All day long. And that's, and in close range gunfighting, if I remember correctly, because it wasn't that long ago when I took the course, a lot of emphasis is on getting good hits.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting good multiple hits.
Getting good multiple hits, that's right.
And life is precious, so be generous with the magazine.
And with the ammo, right?
Yeah.
Well, good explanation on that, because, you know, one of the things I hate, I absolutely despise, are caliber arguments and really gun arguments. And, you know, when I asked you the question, I wasn't asking that to pick on anybody that carries a 1911, because I've seen some pretty damn good shooters and people that could probably get themselves out of a lot of trouble with a 1911.
Hey,
so
we got a guy in class here. The second time he trained with us, he's a, you know, ex-Marine, carries a 1911, and, you know, sometimes the instructors like to show off after class, just messing around. And, you know, he was there right with the instructors who were shooting steels at 100 yards and 200 yards. And, you know, he was keeping up right along with his 1911. So there's nothing wrong with a 1911 if that's your choice. The only issue is for me, for a lot of the guys that have seen the kind of stuff that I have, you know, the Glock is easy to carry, has a lot of ammo, and the bullets are, you know, modern anti-personnel bullets are very, very effective today.
Yeah, and they really don't cost that much either.
No.
So you've been all around the world, Gabe, and you've seen a lot of stuff. How important is capacity?
You know, I think it is because, you know, bad guys today, let me back up. There's a couple of things that we as Americans have always done historically, and you know what? We keep doing it today. We underestimate our enemies and we forget history. And, you know, the bad guys today, you know, we cannot underestimate them. They're very skilled. They're very capable. You know, they're just as good as any good guy. The only difference is they have different philosophies about right and wrong. A lot of guys, you know, they'll wear, you know, some sort of body armor. They'll come to do whatever evil act they're going to do with additional help and so on. And there you are with your 5-shot revolver and you got 3 bad guys. What are you going to do? You know, in theory, you should have enough ammo, but the reality is that it's not going to be enough ammo. I have a student in the South that recently was a victim of a home invasion. You know, 3 bad guys, you know, one kicked his door and they started coming into his house and, you know, he was carrying a 6-shot weapon and, you know, he shot the first guy, he shot the second guy and he came up to shoot the third guy. The third guy thought better of it, turned around and ran away. And then he looked at his pistol and he'd gone to slide lock. Okay. So had the third guy not been a coward and decided to press the issue, you know, we can kind of discern what the results would have been there. Well, he has switched to a high capacity weapon now.
Well, yeah, I can see why. Well, and that's a good example. And, John, what's your experience has been? I mean, you know, why don't you weigh in on the high capacity?
Nobody's ever lost a gunfight from having too many BBs.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
You've got a Glock 17 or a Glock 19. A Glock 19 is one of my everyday carry pistols. When I don't feel like carrying a pistol, I carry a Glock 26. You know, even with a Glock 26, I still have 11 rounds with a standard magazine. That's twice the capacity of a Smith & Wesson Model 36 or a Model 60, any of the J-Franks. That's twice
and it weighs about the same.
It weighs about the same.
That's right.
Why wouldn't I carry more ammo that's just as convenient? You ever tried to hide a speed loader?
No, I've never tried to hide a speed loader.
When you get a chance, compare a speed loader, such as of the start the brand HKS speed loader, and compare the diameter of the speed loader to the diameter of the cylinder of the small frame revolver. They're the same stinking size. Why? Because you've got to have something that holds those five rounds to put those five rounds into that cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
So the hardest part of the revolver to conceal is the cylinder. So now you're in effect carrying another cylinder and you have to use the same amount of real estate to hide it.
Yeah. And now you're still at 10 rounds, which the Glock 26 carries 10 rounds in the magazine to begin with.
Exactly. And, you know, how simple is it to buy a Glock plus two adapter to modify that magazine to carry 12 rounds?
Mm-hmm.
So now you're carrying 12 rounds of the magazine and one of the pipe. That's 13 rounds, huh? That sounds kind of like the Browning High Power, doesn't it? That came out in 1935.
It did. Oh, that's when it came out, 1935?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Gabe, your example about the guy that was at Slide Lock and he's lucky that the third guy ran away, that's powerful.
Yeah. Well, you know, those are lessons that, you know, we keep relearning. And, you know, the traditionalists, they would say, well, you know, his marksmanship wasn't good enough because, he had plenty of rounds there and so on and so forth. But, you know, when I hear stuff like that, what I think is there's a guy that's never been in a gunfight because, you know, to think that you're never going to miss, that you're never going to need more than one shot for adversary and so on, boy, that's pretty arrogant. You know, anybody that has actually been in life-threatening situations, you know, and against quality opponents, people that were hard guys that were actually trying to kill them and stuff like that, people don't go down that easy. They take two, three, maybe even four shots. And, you know, if you've got a pistol that only holds six or seven shots, and, you know, and you've got three guys that are coming at you, each one is going to take four shots because they're tough guys and, you know, they're not convinced that they're going to go down. You're going to, you know, be overdrawn on your ballistic paycheck there eventually.
Well, and given the ballistic paycheck, I like that. and given the fact that all handguns do suck in terms of stopping power, you're right. It is arrogant to think that all I need is one shot for each person.
Yeah. Bob, have you ever experienced a force on force?
No, I haven't. That's on my bucket list.
I've been with Swords International for 2 years now, and I've attended Force on Force, and now I'm teaching Force on Force, and I have never seen an exercise where someone shoots somebody with one BB.
In Force on Force training?
Doesn't happen. When you have someone pressing the attack, and you're having to move to get out of the way, and you're trying to put rounds on target, I've never seen somebody shoot once.
Yeah. Do those airsoft pistols hurt?
No, Bob, no. They don't hurt at all.
yeah, right, sure.
All you need is a t-shirt and some safety glasses.
Well, you know, they hurt a little bit, but it's not what I would say extreme pain. You know, it's bothersome to get shot a little.
Yeah. So, John, you don't see him just take one shot, do you?
Oh, no, not at all. Even some of the guys that can hit a 8-inch plate at 100 yards with their handgun, you know, you're talking about great marksmen. When someone's pressing the attack and they're having to juke and jive and move and get out of the way, they're, you know, 4, 5, 6-round bursts.
With no sight pictures.
Yeah, with no sight picture. That's the reality of the fight.
Well, you know what? You just led me into the very next question. I got two more questions, and then we can start to wrap it up, unless you guys got more that you want to add. You know, you say no sight pictures. Well, now there's an interesting, because, you know, I've said on this show many times, and the limited amount of training I've had, you know, one of the things I learned real quickly in your classes, Gabe, and, you know, I'll give credit to Glenn Matthews because he really drove this point home, is the sights just freaking don't matter most of the time. And a lot of people seem to place a lot of importance on that. You know, I'm not going to say they don't matter at all, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the answer I'll give you is it depends on the fight. If you have a proactive fight, and by proactive, I mean that you're not surprised, you know, you don't have to move to get out of the way, you're already behind cover and so on. Why wouldn't you use the sights? You would use the sights.
Yeah, in that case, yeah.
Yeah, you know, if you have a bad guy behind cover that, you know, it's kind of peeking out and all you have is, you know, just a sliver of his eye and his gun muzzle and stuff like that. Or, you know, heaven forbid, you know, you grab the family member as a hostage and that sort of thing. You know, you need the sights. You need the marksmanship.
Yeah. Right?
But in circumstances where you're taken unawares, you're being ambushed, in other words. You know, you're attacked and now you're reacting from already, you know, behind the power curve, as it were. You know, where it's close range, you're having to move, you're having to shoot while you're moving and that sort of thing. Then basically all that you're going to be doing is you're going to be point shooting into the mass of the target. You know, for that, you really don't need sights. What we teach is we teach a full continuum of shooting where, you know, on the one extreme, you are completely proactive, you know, you know the fight's going to start, you take a position of advantage, the pistol's out, you're on the sights, you're following all the fundamentals of marksmanship and everything else, that's all well and good. We also teach all throughout and to the other extreme where, you know, you're at close range in a phone booth, you know, some guy's got one hand on your shirt, you've got another hand with a hatchet, he's going to bring him down on your melon, you know, and you have to somehow extricate yourself from that, draw your pistol and point shoot him. You know, those two extremes, we teach everything on each end and everything in between.
That's comprehensive.
It's necessary.
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, it is.
At today's things. Okay, let's look at mixed martial arts. Here recently, I guess it's been within the last 8 months, a world-ranked heavyweight boxer got into the ring with a mixed martial artist. He didn't make it past the first round. Very skilled with his hands.
Yeah.
Didn't make it past the first round before he got choked out. Okay. You have to be a well-rounded fighter. You know, if you're going to be in the fight game as far as combat arts, you have to know how to strike. You have to know how to grapple. You know, you have to know how to do submissions. You can't go into the situation and be a top-ranked Taekwondo fighter and expect to do well because you're out of your element.
Yep.
We build complete fighters.
Yeah, and you build complete shooters.
Well, I look at it.
Put it this way. We build complete fighters that are shooters.
Ah, okay, good point. I didn't think of it that way. That's good.
Just the term shooting, this doesn't cover what we did.
No, you build complete fighters that are good shooters. That's good. Yeah. You know, speaking of MMA, I got to brag on my son a little bit who's sitting in the room next to me. In July of this year, he's 13 years old. He's going to earn his black belt in MMA.
Oh, wonderful.
So I told him, I said, it's a good start, son.
Yeah,
it's a good start. So, Gabe, how do you feel about pocket guns, pocket 380s?
You know, they're okay. There are guys that operate in environments that, you know, I kind of call them non-permissive environments. Okay. You know, what I mean by that is let me see if I can be careful on how I say this. There are outside influences that prevent you from carrying a full-size pistol. I think that was vague enough, but clear enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you know, but the danger to your life is still there. So, you know, what do you do? You know, carrying a holster, you know, it's kind of a telltale thing. You know, for some people, hiding a full-size pistol is going to be difficult in those environments. Having a pocket pistol, you know, a 380, a Kel-Tec type thing, a J-frame, it's better than nothing. And, if that's all that you can manage, then, you know, by all means, I'm not going to tell you not to carry that. But you have to be realistic about what the smaller pistols are going to do. They're not as easy to shoot as the larger pistols. You know, you take a Glock 26, for example, very small 9mm. You know, it's a good pistol, but you're not going to be able to shoot it as well as a Glock 19 or 17 because it's just hard to control in comparison to the larger pistols. You know, you start getting into the smaller calibers, you know, 380s, 32s, 25s, and things like that. Think of those like, you know, a small Spyderco Endura, and you're taking that to a fight against someone that's armed with a machete. Okay, it's going to rely a lot on your timing, your skill, and everything else, and you're starting behind the power curve to a degree. Now, it's better than going into that machete fight with no knife at all, but you know, you understand that you're giving up quite a bit for the ability to carry this thing with you.
Yeah. And, you know, that's so true, and I agree with you 100%. I recently have pretty much, I mean, I can't remember the last time I slid my little 380 in my pocket, because it's just not, you know, with enough diligence and enough practice, it's just not that hard to conceal a decent-sized pistol anymore.
Right. Yeah, you have to dress for the gun. You know, most guys, when they're trying to first carry weapons with them, you know, they'll dress like they normally dress. You know, they dress like the Beach Boys or something. Right? And then they go, okay, well, where am I going to put my gun? You know, then they're in an impasse. I don't have a place to put my gun. And then they'll shrink the gun so that it fits the dress. We do it the other way around. Look, you're going to carry your Glock 17, you're going to carry two magazines, you're going to carry some sort of folding knife in your pocket. That's a given. You're going to do that every time you step out of the house. Great. Now, how do you dress around that?
How do you dress around the full-size gun?
Yeah. You know, you make a decision. I'm going to dress around the fact that I'm going to carry this equipment with me.
Okay.
You know, you buy your clothes, you know, your fashion, everything else is based on you being armed. And then it's not a big deal to conceal the gun.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, and that's true. However, you were talking about non-permissive environments, and let me just bring up one real quickly. There are a few times where I'll slide my 380 in my pocket, and here's one of them. I was in Las Vegas all last week. I was there on business, and I was asked to do a training class on one of the products that we sell. And I had about 32 business people in this room, and I'm giving a seminar. It's going to be a little tough having a Glock 19 appendix carry and a Dale Fricke holster with an untucked shirt in front of 32 business people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't argue that at all.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that I'll bring up is this. Okay, now you went to this event, probably, you know, stayed in the hotel room there and everything else.
Yep.
You know, likelihood of an attack taking place here. High probability, low probability. Probably low probability.
Yeah, low.
Not non-existent, but low probability. All right, so what are you going to do? Well, you know, the 380, probably not, not a bad thing to have with you. Okay, you don't need the Glock 17 and two magazines and maybe a backpack with a folding stock AK in it for that environment. Okay, but if you were to take that armament out into the world in uncontrolled environments, places where you don't really know what's going on, you don't have control of who's there and so on, maybe not the best choice.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'd have to say when I was standing there in front of those people that the 380 was in my pocket. Mm-hmm. You know, and, okay, yeah, that's a good point. I got a chuckle out of the folding stock AK in a backpack. That's good.
We put up strange places sometimes.
If you knew some of the business people I was talking to last week, though, there's a couple of them there. Maybe I might have needed my folding stock AK. I don't know. Okay, anything else that you guys want to throw in about close-range gunfighting coming up in Dallas?
Well, you know, what I would say is this. If, you know, to the listener, if you've got your concealed carry permit and, you know, you've been carrying your pistol for a while, you go to the range once in a while and you shoot a little bit and you think you're good, I would say, you know, take a look at this training opportunity, because what it's going to do is it's going to open your eyes to what the real gunfight is going to be like. It's going to show you, you know, the real distances and, you know, discussion about what really happens as opposed to what we think is going to happen. You know, at the training schools that we put on, everybody gets treated like a gentleman or a lady. We don't, you know, we don't look down on the students. We don't, you know, yell at them. It's not like a boot camp kind of thing. You know, it's adult education. You know, you come as an adult, you get treated like an adult. We give you the information that's going to make your life safer and easier.
Good. John, you want to add something to that?
Come on out and expand your horizons.
Well, and I'll second that because, you know, I've been through this course and, you know, the reason I jumped at the chance to repeat this is because, man, you know, if you're not practicing this stuff on a daily basis, you just forget it. You know, 30 days later, I'm scratching my head going, man, I forgot half this stuff. So I'm stoked to repeat it.
Don't forget that you'll need a pen and notebook to take notes.
Yeah, I'm going to have to make sure I bring that this time.
The stuff that we teach you in this class, yeah, you can still go to the indoor range and practice your marksmanship. A lot of things that we teach you, you can practice in your backyard, you can practice in your home. You don't need the ammo to practice a lot of these things once you understand the mechanics of how and why they work.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're going to work on in close range gunfighting.
Right. Exactly. Like I said, it's a whole nother realm outside of the standard delivered shooting.
Yeah. Good stuff, guys. I really appreciate your time. This is terrific. It's one of the reasons I like doing this because I learn something every time I do an interview like this.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Bob.
Gabe, thanks for your time. I appreciate it very much. John, thanks for yours.
Thank you. We appreciate the chance to get to have interviews like this and get our message across.
See you in about 6 weeks. Gabe, thanks again.
All right, brother. We'll see you later.
Take care. Many thanks, Gabe and John, and many thanks to all of you for listening. That's pretty much it. Before I close, folks, I want to remind you, thank you so much. Thank you very much for supporting me, for supporting this show. You know, I try to keep this as commercial-free as I can. I have one sponsor, ConcealmentSolutions.com, which I'll talk about, that I talk about every episode. Tremendous holsters, ConcealmentSolutions.com. I just absolutely love the outside the waistband Cobra holsters. The Black Mambas are incredibly good hybrid inside the waistband holsters. He sells mag holder, horizontal mag carriers. Use the coupon code HandgunWorld to get 10% off of anything that Jason Christensen at Concealment Solutions makes. HandgunWorld is your coupon code. You get 10% off. Otherwise, I keep this show pretty commercial free. So you might want to think about supporting me whenever you shop on Amazon. Just use my Amazon link. Many of you do it. I thank you very much. Go to handgunworld.com. Click the Amazon store at my website. Follow that link every time you make an Amazon purchase. And Amazon will give me a little bit of a fee for that, and you'll be supporting me without spending any extra money. How cool is that? If you have just a little bit extra to spend, even as low as $8 a month, $8 a month, Ben Branham and I have put together an excellent video website. Instructional videos, really good instructional videos, anywhere from 2 minutes to about 25 minutes in length. There's over 55 videos at the Shooters Club. Get signed up. It's only $8 a month or $75 a year. You can find that at shootersclubmembers.com or on my website. Last but not least, leave me a voicemail. I'd love to get some questions, feedback, comments from you. A lot of people have done that. You've been on the show. I'll put you on my podcast, 210-646-1727. That's the phone number, and it's kind of a good conversation we could have. 210-646-1727. Seven is the voicemail number. With all that said, folks, I'm Bob Main. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Remember this, folks. Evil does not exist in the holster. It exists in the hearts of men and women. Shoot straight. Shoot safe. Until next week. keep your eyes open, be aware, know your surroundings, and pray and read the Bible every day. I'll talk to you next week. Goodbye.